Let's see how you voted. Here's where the primary races stand as of right now. Governor Inslee with almost 52% of the votes in the gubernatorial race with no other well-known Democrats running. The governor says,
I'm very excited about the prospect of continuing this work. I'm energized by the confidence and the community spirit of Washingtonians that have rallied to my call to fight the pandemic and fight it based on science and common sense and a sense of community responsibility. And people have responded, and I feel in a very close alliance with Washingtonians in that effort. So I'm energized by their commitment, and that's what we need right now. And so, tonight it looks like people want to continue in that course.
Of the governor's 35 challengers, Lauren Culp, police chief of Republic Washington, is out in front with more than 16%. Coming in behind him, former Bothell Mayor Joshua Fried with just over 7.25%. Anti-tax activist Tim Iman with just over 7%. Tri-Cities physician Dr. Raul Garcia just under 5%. And State Senator Phil Fortunato just over 4%. Here's State Republican Party Chair Caleb Heimlich.
I think if it is Culp, then the messaging has got to be on restoring common sense to Olympia in all different facets, whether it's managing the COVID pandemic, whether it's managing how we're doing these lockdowns. I think there's been, Governor Inslee has been choosing winners and losers, deeming certain people essential, others non-essential, in a way that's divided our state. And I think having a common sense approach can help address that. And then I think what we're seeing with Seattle and the lawlessness and the riots and the chaos is not what people, even in King County, want to see. I mean, and so I think there is a chance there, having a police chief getting a message on supporting law enforcement, it's going to be quite the contrast with Governor Inslee.
Looking at the lieutenant governor's race, outgoing Congressman Denny Heck, who decided to run for lieutenant governor after leaving Congress, is on top with 27%. State Senator Marco Lias is second with 17%. And if those numbers hold, that means two Democrats facing each other on the November ballot. Republicans Ann Davison Sattler, Marty McClendon, Dick Murray are not far behind, pulling between 9 and 11% of the vote for lieutenant governor. And with Denny Heck retiring from Congress, his 10th district seat is an open seat. Former Tacoma Mayor Marilyn Strickland is in front right now in that election with more than 21%, followed by State Representative Beth Dolio in second with 14%, followed by former State Representative Christine Reeves. And so far, it's been a big day for incumbents. Kim Wyman, Republican, leads the Secretary of State's race ahead of Gail Tarleton, who's in second. Chris Rakedahl took 40% of the vote for state superintendent. Maya Espinoza is second with 24%. All of Washington's congressional representatives are solidly out in front of their races. And you get all the results at MyNorthwest.com. Seattle's Morning News. As a relatively new grandparent, I find myself fascinated with how infants and toddlers learn to speak. And Dr. Naya Ferian Ramirez is a linguistics and cognitive science professor at the UW who's written a study on how parents talk to their children, and you've called it parentese. So explain what parentese is.
Yeah, thank you. Parentese is a special speaking style that adults use when they talk to their infants and toddlers. It's observed across many languages, and it's much more than just pleasant-sounding speech.
So is it like, what is it like talking to a pet? I mean, what is it like?
It's not entirely like talking to a pet. Another thing to know about parentese is that sometimes this gets confused with baby talk, which baby talk is a combination of silly sounds and words that sometimes even use incorrect grammar. So things like, oh, your shoesy woozies on your cutesy feet, that would be baby talk. Parentese, yes, on the other hand, uses correct grammar and real words, but it does have this higher pitch, a slower tempo, exaggerated intonation, and acoustically exaggerated vowels.
Okay, so the grammar is correct, but it's the intonation that changes to, and is that to capture the baby's attention?
Yeah, so it certainly captures the baby's attention. It also, parentese also has a slower tempo, so it helps babies find where the boundaries between the words are, because typically in fast speech, words run into one another. In parentese, which has a slower tempo, it's easier for children to figure out where the word boundaries are, and that might be one of the reasons why it helps them learn words. The higher pitch captures their attention, and then the exaggerated vowels, what that does is it really helps children figure out what the vowels of their language are, right? They're not necessarily capable of doing that when they're born. And by producing vowels that are exaggerated, we make the vowels like A and E, we make them more different from one another, and that helps babies learn.
So this is like saying, Daddy would like you to put the toys away after you're finished.
Well, the sentence that you just produced is a little long, so it depends on the age of your child, right? So at 6 months, your parentese is going to sound a little different than it would at 18 months. Hmm. But at 6 months, you would say things like, look, it's a truck. Boom, it goes. It's a truck, right? And then there is a lot of repetition of this. And then, you know, sentences do get longer as babies grow and as they start to produce words and language themselves. But parentese does tend to have shorter sentences and lots of repetition, especially for the younger ages.
Now, as far as I know, I mean, this is how my daughter talks to her child a lot. And I don't think, I mean, she is actually studying to be a speech therapist, but I don't think she was taught that. I think, don't you just learn how to do it yourself based on what the child responds to?
Right. So parentese is used across many languages, and you are absolutely correct that most people use parentese naturally. However, some parents might use it very little and other parents might use it a lot. And we have known for quite a while that the kids who hear more parentese have better language outcomes later on. What we didn't know up until this point is whether parental use of parentese is something that's malleable. Or in other words, if we tell parents that parentese is a good thing, can they enhance how much they use it and in what situations they use it? And in this study, we show that this is possible and that those parents who enhance their parentese the most have babies with the best language outcomes.
So parents shouldn't feel embarrassed or shy about using this. You found that
Absolutely.
The more they use this, the better their child will learn.
Right. And that was one of the purposes of this study, was to actually inform parents about what parentese is and what it does and why, what the science behind it actually shows. When we ask parents, do you know what parentese is? Some parents knew, others didn't, and many parents had no idea that they use it themselves until we played back their recordings, and then they said, oh, you know, this is me using parentese. I never knew, right? So the purpose was to really draw their attention to the benefits of parentese, to show them that they do actually use it, and then tell them, start using more of it.
Is there some reason that parents typically, at least in my experience, will use the third person, as in, mommy doesn't want you to do that, daddy wishes you would stop, etc.?
Yeah, so sometimes we will see that, and for the most part, what this is related to is that very young children, they don't always understand that pronouns such as you, they have to be inverted when they use them, right? So if you tell a toddler, I'm going to pick you up, right?
Yeah.
If the child wants to say, pick me up, they have to invert the pronoun to get it right. And very young children have a hard time doing that. And we as parents are sensitive to that, so we will adjust our speech accordingly. And so it takes children quite a while to figure out the pronouns, but they eventually do. But so we didn't really look at that in this study.
Now, you mentioned an app, and I'm sure everyone wants to know how to get it. So where can you find it?
Oh, the app that I was talking about is called Room, and what it is these are concrete research-based tips for providing parents with age-appropriate moments or occasions during the day, such as diaper changes, such as trips to the grocery store, where they have a chance to talk to their child and to interact with their child to enhance their language development. There's a website called vroom.org, or there's also the Vroom app.
So that would be vroom.org. And there it is. It says, "Hello, Brain Builder."
There you go.
Vroom tips help you do more with your shared moments. Well, good. It's good to know that it's backed up by research. So did this surprise you? I mean, do you have kids of your own? Do you use this on them?
I have three children of my own, yes, and I definitely use Parentese and lots of back and forth, right? So that's another piece to emphasize is that Parentese, what we think is happening is that Parentese really captures baby's attention and it draws them into conversation, into this back and forth that then happens between parents and children, and we think that this back and forth is then what really grows children's language, right?
Right.
So yes, I absolutely use Parentese at home.
And your kids will be at the UW when they turn 12, I'm guessing.
No, I don't think so. We'll see.
Dr. Naya Ferrian-Ramirez, Linguistics and Cognitive Science Professor, University of Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
To be where little cable cars.
Little cable cars. Where do they go? Where do they go?
Climb halfway.
Halfway to the stars. That's where they go. Felix Spinell joins us now, brought to us by the King County Library System. Trolleys and streetcars have a long and tortured relationship with Seattle, including at the ballot box this morning after the primary. And our resident historian Felix Spinell says that once upon a time, San Francisco-style cable cars were even part of the public transit mix in Seattle until 80 years ago this week when they disappeared.
Yeah, it's this coming Monday, very early on the morning of August 10th, 1940. The old Yesler cable car ended its final run after 52 years of hauling people from Pioneer Square all the way over the hill to Leschi Park with all its beautiful attractions down there on Lake Washington. The Yesler route was the last of the Seattle cable cars to go after the Madison and James Street routes went away a little bit before that. This was during a time when the entire street railway system, and system might be an exaggeration, was being scrapped and replaced with electric so-called trackless trolley buses and some gas and diesel coaches. Now, the Yesler route was the oldest. It first went into operation in September 1888. That's a long time ago. And now, even though it's been 80 years since the Yesler route shut down, there are still a handful of artifacts around. Excuse me. In the past few days, I've walked parts of the old route, and I drove it, too. I couldn't find any leftover tracks or obvious evidence above the ground. I would guess that the metal stuff was plucked away for World War II scrap drives. Now, a signature element of the run, and considered to be one of the most remarkable pieces of public transportation infrastructure around, was this huge wooden trestle. It stretched from Yesler at about 32nd Avenue, crest of the hill there, 500 feet across a big ravine and as high as 200 feet above the ground,
wow,
all the way down to ground level at Lake Washington. The wooden trestle is long gone. It was demolished probably not long after the route shut down in 1940. I went to the ravine myself and poked around. I asked the Parks Department. They don't think there's anything left from that huge trestle, but I feel like there's got to be at least a concrete footing or two. Maybe when I retire, I'll spend some time looking there with a shovel. Now, there is a fairly significant piece still in place because in 1912, a concrete overpass was built for the trestle to let Lake Washington Boulevard traffic get through, and that concrete portion is still there right in the middle of Leschi Park. It's an incredible artifact. It's just this gorgeous sort of, I don't know if it's Art Deco exactly or what style it is, but it's just it stands out from any other piece of local infrastructure in the city. Of course, the tracks and the other stuff's all long gone, but the overpass, you can still use it on foot or on bike or whatever. Now, in that period there around 1940, Seattle got kudos for how quickly it shut down its old street railway system and got rid of stuff, so much so that during World War II, people thought, gee, why'd we get rid of all those things? They would have been handy with this big boom we're experiencing right now. But city officials should also get some kind of kudos for preserving two of the three earliest cable cars that actually ran on the Yesler route way back in 1888. Now, there might be some listeners who remember the old Mohai in Montlake and the old Yesler cable car that was displayed there from the 50s to the 80s.
Right.
Check with Mohai earlier this week. That cable car is in storage. There's no plans to bring it back. Now, I said that two of the three cars were preserved. One thing that I always heard people say at Mohai when I worked there, and this is sort of said as a point of pride, you know, the only other Yesler cable car is in the Smithsonian. To find out if that was true, I spoke to Peter Liebhold, a curator at the National Museum of American History.
Quite often people will say, oh, that object is in the Smithsonian or the only other one that's in the Smithsonian. And sadly, many of those stories turn out not to be true. The sort of apocryphal notion of things being in the Smithsonian aren't always correct. In this case, it really is true that this is a prized object that we acquired and have been delighted to have, and it's really a significant piece. And so the people of Seattle should be really quite proud of the fact that that their history and commitment to early cable car public transportation is something that's being preserved and is in the national collections.
Impressive.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. A donation was made to the Smithsonian way back in 1937. The cable car was only 49 years old at that point, and I'm older than that. Now, the cable car was sent by ship from Seattle to Washington, D.C., and the whole package was more of a Seattle cable car action playset.
The cable car was given to us along with 60 feet of rail and all the pulleys and mechanisms so that we could actually operate it. And then I think there was a great desire to do that. I don't believe we did actually ever operate it. When it first arrived in D.C., they did sort of a quick restoration job to it. But later in the 1960s, that work was more professionally done, so that it was fully restored and cleaned up to a really a great degree.
Now, a couple things I learned from Peter, that Seattle cable car, it's the only cable car the Smithsonian has in its collection. You'd think they'd have something from San Francisco, but no, they only have Seattle.
Well, because San Francisco's still using theirs.
Exactly. Maybe someday when they finally come to their senses. I guess cable cars were first used in coal mines in the mid-19th century, this notion of having a remote power source moving a cable under the ground. And I didn't understand that as a kid. I thought cable car and trolleys were interchangeable, but cable cars it's gripping a moving cable under the street. And that's why Peter told me this. Cable cars make a lot of sense in cities with hilly topography, because those old-fashioned streetcars with just electric power or whatever, the traction would often fail on steep hills. The wheels would just spin. And that doesn't happen when you're gripping a cable under the street. And that's why they really hung on in Seattle for as long as they did. Now, finally, Peter Leipold from the Smithsonian suggested that, as anachronistic as it might seem, cable cars could be more practical now than ever.
In this time of pandemic, the cable car would actually be relatively safe form of transportation. It's not terribly enclosed. So it has sort of a bench, a central bench with a roof over it, but only poles supporting it. So it's really quite an al fresco operation.
Yeah.
You know, and that First Hill trolley now travels part of the old Yes Sir cable car route.
Right.
And in the 1930s, there were people in Seattle who said, we ought to save one of these as a tourist attraction. I mean, they're really ahead of their time, because in 1947, San Francisco tried to kill their system, and the voters overwhelmingly approved saving those as a tourist attraction. Here we are, almost 75 years later. Now, we have a huge gallery at My Northwest of something like 20 photos going back to the early 20th century of cable cars in Seattle. It's really this forgotten chapter of the city's history, and it would be so cool to, I don't think we're going to bring them back, but the notion of having one up and down those steep hills, it's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, we got to get that full sound transit thing built out before we put the cable cars back.
Yeah, it's way down the list, probably. Yeah. Maybe cable cars to Northgate.
Yeah. Not sure if they could go 55 miles an hour. Felix Bunnell, brought to us by the King County Library System, and all of his features are available anytime at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Patrick O'Day. Did you hear that temperature from the newsroom? It's 74 degrees. Look at that blue sky. Welcome, everybody, to the Pat O'Day program. This is Mitch Ryder, the Detroit Wheel.
Pat O'Day. We asked Felix to stay a little longer this morning because we wanted to take time to mark the passing of a legendary voice.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, the giant crowds on its feet as the bicycle-powered Tiny Unlimited of Battle for the Gold. On the outside is TV John Cheester in his Miss Thriftway. Then little Billy Wickster pulling the pan back. Dave Dieter with his Golden Machine. And here they come! On the inside, all of a sudden taking the lead already, is Felix Bunnell streaking across the Tumwater as he yanks Miss Olympia beer on to victory. Champion Felix, nice going.
Yeah. Pat O'Day.
How did you score that take?
You know, that's the kind of guy Pat was. 86 years old. He passed away on San Juan Island yesterday. He'd been ill for some time, but still very active. You know, legendary Renaissance man of Northwest pop culture, music history. Really good friend of Seattle's Morning News. Whenever I could think of an excuse to call Pat, I would. We talked to him back in March about cruising in Colby up in Everett. We talked to him a couple of years ago about those street hydroplanes that people pull behind their bikes. And that's when he indulged a fantasy of mine and called a race where I beat John Keister, Bill Wixey, and Dave Dieterer pulling the Miss Olympia behind my bicycle. But, you know, he was born Paul Berg in Nebraska and moved to the Northwest when he was just a little kid during World War II and adopted that Pat O'Day name as a DJ at KAYO back in the late 50s. Really hit his stride in the 1960s and is synonymous with KJR. He, you know, there's old tape of the Beatles doing their press conference right before they performed at the Climate Pledge Arena in 1964. I don't think it was called that yet. It was called something else. Anyway, but you hear Pat O'Day off mic saying, "Come on, it's time to go to the concert." And, you know, his voice is just, it's so recognizable to anyone of a certain age. And, he had a concert promotion business. He did all these teen dances, just really figured out how to tie into youth culture. And as we heard in that little intro there, when we started this bit here, he's got this archetypal DJ voice, really kind of a theater of the mind kind of guy, and painting these pictures and creating these characters. You know, KJR did this thing where kids could call in and talk to the real Santa Claus. And it was Pat who was the voice of Santa Claus. And they had all these little tapes where they could play little short bits of him responding to kids, like with typical answers. Just really saw radio as this personal thing. And anytime Pat and I would talk, which was, you know, a couple times a year, we would always get to about the what radio meant to people and how radio, more than any other medium, really is personal. And if you're good at your job on radio, people really, they may not agree with everything you say, but they grow comfortable and familiar with your voice, and they come to depend on you for this connection to the local community. And Pat always, he had a fantasy. He would tell me that he would love to own a station again, have it populated with local talent, play music, the weather, do that kind of mix of general material, so it wasn't to one particular niche other than to people of that area. So he never gave up on that fantasy. And he did call the hydroplanes, I think, for something like 50 years, starting back in the late 60s. I have one more little bit of tape here. This is Pat doing the very famous KJR jingle that everybody remembers. This is Pat doing it for us a couple months ago.
KJR, Seattle, Channel 95.
I love that. You know, and it's been a tough year for the KJR voices that a lot of people remember. Gary Lockwood and Charlie Brown passed away a couple months ago. It's really from a different time when instead of listening to music on, you know, your phone or other devices and curating your own playlist, you depended on a guy like Pat to curate
your
playlist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Music radio was he was the golden age music. And I grew up in New York, and you know, I was Cousin Brucey and Danny and guys like that. But yeah, as a teenager, I was just glued to the radio. That's where you got your music from.
Yeah, and he would break new records, like the Ventures, who went on to become this incredible, famous instrumental band. He played their first self-produced 45, the one their mom paid to produce. He played it as a part of the top of the hour news break, and it caught on, and people started calling in, and that's the kind of make or break ability he had. And he recognized the value of local bands like the Wailers and the Ventures and the Sonics, stuff that bands that went on to have very influential careers, if not super well known anymore today, but just from a different time. And a really great guy, always very kind to us, always willing to weigh in with perspective or history from the last, you know, 60 plus years where he had a huge impact on this whole region.
Yeah. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
Pat O'Day, rest in peace. As you know, there's a big day ahead in the conversation over defunding the Seattle police, and we go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott for the details.
Community groups that have been demanding cuts of 50% to SPD starting in 2020 are already not happy with the proposals on the table at this morning's budget committee vote that, despite making cuts to the department, are nowhere near what they felt 7 of 9 council members had originally committed to. The group plans to march from the youth jail on 12th and Alder to City Hall in a day-long event that starts at noon to call on the council to do the right thing and defund the SPD by half in 2020. But as many on the council acknowledged late last week and again Monday, it's just not possible because of legal and bargaining issues this year. Sentiment echoed by Mayor Durkin yesterday.
Our 2020 proposal included $20 million in cuts to the Seattle Police Department budget this year, which represents 10% of the budget for the remainder of the year. These cuts were driven by the full involvement of the Seattle Police Department and Chief Carmen Best, which is the right way to go about transforming the Seattle Police Department. The city charter vests in Chief Carmen Best the management responsibilities for the Seattle Police Department. Since we transmitted our balancing package, the chief and I have emphasized that those cuts were all that were feasible this year in order to accommodate the process of moving things out of the department, as well as making sure that we could maintain a level for public safety. Anything beyond that $20 million, we knew and were advised, would be tangled up in various legal proceedings.
Durkin says,
I've got to be clear because some people just don't understand. The chief and I share the goal of much of Seattle. We want to lead the nation in reimagining policing. We know that we can do that and still protect public safety and have a system in place where people get the help they need 24/7 in every part of the city. Again, nearly a month ago, Chief Best and I expressed serious concerns about cutting the 2020 budget for the Seattle Police Department by an arbitrary 50%. You're going to hear it straight from us. But against that backdrop, 7 of 9 council members announced that they supported a 50% cut this year. But now most of the 7 council members who made that pledge now acknowledge that a blunt 50% cut in 2020 is not only ill-advised.
And she appeared to be calling for a unified approach, explaining both she and the police chief and the council all appear to be wanting the same things. They just need to slow down the process a bit because of the various legalities.
We are ready to go back to the table. We have told community we want them at the table. We want a contract that reflects the values of Seattle. But we cannot, again, just lay off 100 officers. And next year's plan would perhaps be another 100 to 200. That would be a reduction of almost 300 officers in a 14-month period.
As for SPD Chief Carmen Best,
there is absolutely no question that we will do better. The Seattle Police Department is a national model because of our commitment to continuously improving. We have met and exceeded every component of the consent decree. We continue to demonstrate that we are committed to innovation. We have embraced transparency and oversight and have one of the most robust civilian accountability systems in the country.
Best added,
there are some good approaches in the proposals. Some of the ideas SPD already had and has raised before. But what is problematic is these are approaches without any clarity on how they will become reality. What is the plan? The push from council and some of our community is to do these large-scale changes in 2020 with no practical plan for community safety.
Meantime, others are also urging caution when it comes to discussions around slashing police budgets and size of force. King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg saying yesterday they've seen a major spike in gun violence for the first half of 2020.
What I've found so far is that in the first half of 2020, that many more people have been shot than the average over the last 4 years that we've kept track. In fact, 140 people have been shot with firearms so far this year. 36 of them died, which is a 44% increase over last year. And 104 people were shot. They didn't die, but that's a 16% increase over last year. So we're seeing just a lot more violence than I think we anticipated.
On top of that,
clearly that gun violence has a disproportionate impact on communities with Black and Indigenous and people of color. In fact, 73% of the people shot so far this year, 73%. Have been from communities of color.
We'll have to wait and see how this all shakes out when the council votes on amendments later today on the SPD's 2020 budget.
Well, this is discouraging, Hannah. As I come back from vacation, basically a news blackout, I'm hearing the same things discussed, and I don't hear any leadership coming from the community of demonstrators. If the community wants to police itself, it could have been doing that for years. You can organize blocks, you can organize neighborhoods, to find out who's causing the violence and do something about it. And now this has all become a numbers game. We got to cut it by 50% without any explanation as to how that's going to work or how it would improve things.
Yeah, I mean, it's this kind of this large talking point, and it really is just simply not possible. And even I reported that the council members themselves admitted that to these groups on Monday's meeting, during Monday's meeting. But they also passed resolutions with their signaling their intent to do much more in 2021, as has the mayor. She's got, I think, $76 million she's identified that would reduce the size of the department, but it's mostly by shifting things around so that the groups don't like that. They want this overall change. Some of these groups that are making these demands eventually hope to see all community policing and no typical, what we have right now, a regular police department at all. But Councilmember Andrew Lewis and others have told me that that is not the agenda for anyone on the council, except perhaps maybe Shama Sawant, to abolish the entire Seattle Police Department.
All right, it is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. A handshake is a handshake, and sometimes it's worth a whole lot more. A Western Wisconsin man is going to share his millions in lottery winnings with a longtime friend because of a promise they made to each other nearly three decades ago. Katie Beck is with NBC News.
$22 million.
And I said, are you jerking my bobber?
A stunning prize tied to a promise between longtime friends Tom Cook and Joseph Feeney.
We said whenever the big winner comes, we're going to split it. So we buy every week and, And thinking it would happen.
That happened many years ago. It's just kind of continued.
Almost 20, I think.
Handshake's a handshake, man.
That handshake was in 1992. Three decades of trying their Wisconsin lottery luck. And finally, last month,
we've got 41, 54.
A win split in half.
It's quite an experience when I read them first two or three numbers and I kind of froze.
Both men now retired and ready for the good life.
I got grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and all I can spend time with them, well, I can't think of a better way to retire.
You can't pick the winning numbers, but lucky for all of us, you can pick true friends. These two hit the jackpot on both counts. Katie Beck, NBC News.
Each splitting $22 million. Not too bad, Dave. Would that be a good way to go into
$22 million each?
No, they're going to split it.
They're that's
so
still
11,
a lot of money.
Yeah,
$11 million. Wow.
For a promise made kind of as a joke. Three decades ago. Yay, if we ever win, we'll split it.
Did I make that agreement with you?
No, but you want to go for it now? I'm going to Paul play Powerball tonight. What the heck?
I don't know.
Maybe I could finally, afford a razor. Or a weed whacker at this point.
That's what I was going to say. The razor has not been designed that could handle this beard at this point.
It's true.
Now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G Scott. I missed our little talks, so I thought that since you've been there and I haven't, what big things did I miss?
Oh, you missed a few things. First of all, I just want to tell you, Dave, it's the first time I actually have said this to you before and actually mean it. So if I ever said it before, I didn't mean it, but now I mean it. I missed you, man.
Really?
I really did. Well, I want to be specific over to what I miss.
Yes.
I miss my introduction.
You do?
Yeah, your introduction, man, is just it's top notch.
Really? You think it has enough energy and gets the job done, creating excitement for your appearance?
Fam, you got that Barry White voice. You know what I mean?
I think so, huh?
I think I know what happened.
The slow jam with G. Scott.
I know what happened when you met your significant other.
What?
I know you probably went up to her, and once you said, I'm Dave Ross, and she was smitten, wasn't she?
No, that would not be it. No.
Okay.
Actually, I was auditioning her voice, and I said, I really like your voice, so let's go out. And that seemed to work.
Okay, Dave.
Yes.
Here's what you miss, and I know the listeners are going to say, well, you didn't remember this. Wow, we don't have that much time. You missed President Donald Trump giving well wishes for an alleged sex trafficker in Ghislaine Maxwell, but didn't have anything nice to say about John Lewis because he didn't come to his party.
I did see that. I was astounded.
Yeah, you see.
Because he actually said, here's the thing about him. He's completely authentic. I mean, who else would come out and say, look, he didn't come to my inauguration, so I'm not going to go to his funeral?
You know what? Fair. You're right about that. The dude is authentic. Like, no doubt about it. Let's see. Here locally, folks keep going to the homes of our public servants.
Oh, and demonstrating?
Yeah, yeah, that's a new thing now, which I absolutely disagree
Didn't
with.
Didn't some of the neighbors come out and defend Carmen Best's home when that happened?
Yeah, I mean, they would defend
their Second Amendment right, as I recall.
I think anybody would defend their neighbor, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm older now. I would defend my neighbor. Back in my 20s and 30s, I had some neighbors that I would not defend. But today, yeah, I'm defending my neighbors. I love my neighbors.
Would you consider that vigilantism?
In that case, in my neighborhood, yes.
What about in the Carmen Best case?
Meaning, would I be the neighbor?
The neighbors who came out, is that something that we should celebrate or worry about?
Yeah, I'm celebrating that. Sorry.
Are you? Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, anybody that wants to protect their neighborhood, then good for you. I'm celebrating that. Let's see, what else you missed?
Oh, I'll tell you what you missed.
What's that?
Miss G going camping with a suitcase and an air mattress the size of this studio,
all
Dave.
Right, Sully.
What?
All right,
I Sully. Went there. Yeah, I did.
Oh, Dave, see what had happened?
Yeah.
I went camping, first of all. Second, I didn't know that you're not supposed to bring a suitcase. And everybody, including your listeners, my listeners, everybody's laughing at me for bringing a suitcase.
You went camping where?
Is it Lake Easton?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Lake Easton.
You mean Easton?
Easton, right. Yeah, Easton. Is it E-A-S-T-O-N?
Yeah, right across the pass there.
Yeah, yeah. So I went out there.
I see. So you brought a suitcase, like a piece of airplane luggage?
Yeah,
exactly. Like a roller? How would you get that up the trail?
What do you mean, Dave? You just roll it. Bump it, bump, bump, bump. You just roll it.
Seriously? What about you didn't take a backpack?
Why do I need a backpack, Dave? Why does it matter?
It's a trail.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it shouldn't matter that I need a backpack. Anyway, you know what? Sully, he's dirty. He's low down for this.
Yeah, I am.
Okay, so, and then I brought sheets.
You brought sheets?
I brought sheets and a comforter for my air mattress.
Your air mattress?
What?
How
Dave.
Big is it? So, and you hand pumped it?
Well, no, you have the electric. You have,
there's no electricity. Where is this?
It was a little plug-in. It's a little plug-in down the way. I went and blew that thing up and carried.
So you were
car
camping then?
What do you mean? I'm camping. What? See, that's another thing I've learned about camping. Like, if I'm going to go camping, people just knock down everything I did. Well, that's not real camping. That's not. Well, what is real camping?
I'm just asking what it is, because if there's an outlet up there that I didn't know about, then I'll bring my air mattress too. But as far as I know, they don't have outlets on the trails.
What is it, Dave? What is it about when folks go camping and then folks want to knock you down and say, "Well, that's not real camping." What's real camping, Dave?
I don't know. I'm just asking you what your camping experience was like, so I can get some tips the next time I go. Because the only times I've been camping, it's been really uncomfortable. Never involved an air mattress or a rolling suitcase. It always involved an overstuffed backpack, which was really annoying to carry. A lot of people who had no deodorant and never showered, and marginal food. It sounds like you found a better way to do it.
So that's another thing. No, now the one thing I couldn't do, and the one thing that I just don't understand, like, look, I made it one night, okay? And the fact that I made it the entire night, I did not go in my car. Uh-huh. I was proud of myself.
Okay.
But, Dave, what's up with the showering part, man? Like, I can't do that long. Like, how do people go camp for 2 and 3 days and don't shower?
Well, because there's no showers there. Unless you want to take a dip in a frozen mountain stream.
My body does not hold up that long, man.
I know what you mean.
I just can't.
They have a hut system where you can go from hut to hut, and it's got showers and it's got food there, and you don't have to have a really heavy backpack. But the times I've gone hiking in the Cascades, if you want to camp, you got to take all the stuff with you. And there's no electrical outlets up there.
Well, so Dave, you mean to tell me,
yes,
I got a list of things that you missed out on for the 2 weeks you were gone, or however long you were gone.
Yeah.
And you mean to tell me the one that got you sparked up was me camping? Thank you, Sully.
That's what I want to do. Dave's such an outdoorsman. I thought I wanted his take on it.
It's not that you were camping. It's how you were camping. It's how you apparently were able to pull off a luxurious camping trip that the rest of us have not figured out how to duplicate. So I just need to know where you bought that air mattress that plugs into the wilderness. You can tell me where to buy that. I'm getting one.
It's a Costco special, isn't it? I have one.
Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.